From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The science writer Gary Taub's book is his Case Against Sugar. It's the title of the book, The Case Against Sugar. And here it is in a nutshell. Sugar is the trigger for insulin resistance. That's the condition that leads to a whole cluster of illnesses like obesity and diabetes and heart disease. Taub says it's not a trigger, it's the trigger. Sugars, he say, have a unique physiological effect on our bodies. The book is a history of how we got to this point, growing, refining, trading, and of course, consuming more and more. But it's also about the challenges of getting the science right, because Taubes admits he can't yet definitively say sugar is basically a toxin. But we know enough to do something about sugar. Taubes will make his case after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including heart, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some of you may remember, it's been several years ago now, when the science writer Gary Taubes first began his campaign against low-fat diets. At first it was magazine articles, then books. Taubes dug into the science and really challenged the conventional wisdom at the heart of decades of dietary guidelines. Taubes said it's not saturated fat that's causing an obesity epidemic in the world, it's carbohydrates. In his latest book, he narrows in on one type of carb in particular, sugar. And by sugar, he means sucrose, you know, table sugar and high fructose corn syrup. Sugar, he says, is unique. It has a very particular hormonal and metabolic effect on our bodies. It's the trigger to a cluster of problems that have emerged over the last 100 years or so. Today in the program, Gary Taubes is joining us to make The Case Against Sugar. That's the title of the book. Taubes is a co-founder of the Nutrition Science Initiative. It's a nonprofit research organization. His writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Esquire. He joined us from the studios of the Journalism School at the University of California, Berkeley.
I want to begin with the idea that you started with. You're obviously pretty familiar with the science of insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome. Pretty familiar with the debate between, you know, dietary fat and carbs as the, you know, the culprit for obesity and heart disease and all of that. But I wonder, did you think that you would be able, when you started this particular enterprise, the book, that you would find, you know, a definitive answer to the question of whether sugar is, you know, the principal trigger for all these problems?
Yeah, and clearly I knew going in that there could be no definitive answer. The studies simply were never done. If you think about what we did to, I would say, refute the dietary fat hypothesis, this idea that saturated fat in our diets is the primary cause of heart disease, we spent probably in the neighborhood of $1 billion, maybe $1.5 billion on clinical trials, the results of which simply failed to support the hypothesis. So these are long-term, you know, 5-10 year trials where you randomize, actually in one case it was 50,000, 49,000 women to a low-fat diet or a regular diet, and then you follow them for years to see who gets more heart disease. And those trials were just never done with sugar. We never got to the point where we even entertained the idea that we should do those trials. Right. And of course, you know, one of my points is we wouldn't do them today because everyone would just naturally assume that if you got, you know, took 50,000 people and got 25,000 of them not to eat sugar, they'd be healthier.
Right.
Why spend the money?
Right. You concede the point right up front that it can't be established definitively that sugar, for example, is a toxin that does damage over decades. And that the evidence, as you say, is not as clear as it is with tobacco. But you also say this isn't, and maybe this is what you were getting at in that other response, it isn't a failure of science, it's an issue of its limits.
Yeah, well, this is, people in general have, and this goes with the researchers in the field, and well, have a poor understanding of what science can and cannot do. And in these situations, I often fall back on Richard Feynman, the Nobel laureate physicist, who usually said anything about this better than other people did. He said, you know, people think you can prove scientific issues, yes or no, true or false. That's simply not the case. What science is about is determining what's the most likely scenario. And, you know, arguably, once you understand what the most likely scenario is, testing that to see if it remains viable. But that's all we can do clearly in nutrition. And so you end up with these situations where the evidence is ambiguous and you have different people interpreting the evidence based on their biases and their preconceptions. The way I phrase it in the book, I say if this was a legal case, the book I'm about to write would be the prosecution's argument.
Right.
And I'm pretty confident I could get an indictment.
Right.
I'm less confident that I could get a conviction, because if your standard of evidence is innocent until proven guilty, then clearly the evidence doesn't exist to prove guilt,
right.
to prove definitively the argument that I'm making.
So in the absence of something definitive right now, you're asking people what, to apply common sense or just Occam's razor, that the simplest hypothesis is usually the right one?
Well, and that's what that's clearly what I evoke in the book.
Yeah.
So the argument, first you have to understand the crime that's being committed. Well, so what are we trying sugar for?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a critical question, because there are a lot of questions that get confused as soon as we start talking about human diets. So in this case, the crime is what we're trying to explain is we have epidemics of obesity and diabetes worldwide.
Right.
Whenever populations transition from their traditional diets or traditional ways of eating to Western diets and lifestyles. And surely there are genetic components to who manifests these diseases and who doesn't, but these epidemics happen in virtually every possible human, strain of humans,
right,
to use the phrase we'd use for strains of mice in laboratory. So, you know, Inuits, Maasai in South Africa, First Nations people, Native American people, Europeans, Middle Easterners, South Pacific Islanders, Aborigines in Australia, and then the Australians themselves. It doesn't matter what type of human you're talking about. They transition to a Western diet. They get epidemics of obesity and diabetes, and sometimes almost mind-blowing numbers. So there are, for instance, First Nations tribes in Canada that in the 1950s you couldn't find a case of diabetes, and today one in two adults are diabetic. So there's something about this Western diet and lifestyle that triggers these diseases. And the conventional thinking is it's just, you know, we just eat too much. People get too much food and it tastes too good, and they don't exercise enough once they become Westernized. And that's the transition. And I think that's kind of an inane hypothesis, and we could discuss that.
Yeah.
And I'm saying the
that.
Prime suspect is just sugar.
Right.
It's sugar in the diets. And that has always been the prime suspect. So, you know, one of the things I do is take this historical approach where I'm asking the question, why did we stop thinking of it as
right.
a prime suspect?
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to get to that, sort of lay that case out. Let me ask you something, though, that you write early on in the book in the introduction. This is something observed by this doctor whom we'll come back to a little bit later. He specialized in diabetes. It's Elliot Joslin. And he said that if this had been he's talking about the incident of the epidemic of diabetes. And he said if this had been an infectious disease rather than diabetes, he said boards of health, insurance agencies, newspapers, the whole country would insist on some kind of action, some kind of answer. But that's not happening with this. And I'm wondering, why generally do you think that is?
Well, and this is what's so fascinating. When Joslin said that was 1920.
Right.
And he was looking at the increase in diabetes just over his professional lifetime since 1890. And by 1920, he's finally saying this is an epidemic. And so I make this point in my writing today. When Joslin said that, he probably would have estimated the incidence prevalence of diabetes in Americans at around maybe 1 in 500 to 1 in 1,000. And today it's 1 in 11. Now, diagnostic criteria have changed, and that would play a major role in this. But say a 100-fold increase in the prevalence of this disease. And like I said, there are other populations where you've got very well documented where it goes from virtually zero diabetics to, you know, 1 in 4 adults, for instance. And recently in October, the Director General of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, gave a talk. She gave a keynote address at the annual meeting of the National Academies of Science, which was dedicated to reversing these epidemics of obesity and diabetes in the U.S. And she called these epidemics slow-motion disasters. And she acknowledged that we have completely failed to control these epidemics, that they just get worse and worse. And then she gave a number, a prediction for what she thought the odds were that we would prevent the current bad situation from getting still worse. And that prediction was virtually zero chance. And so from my perspective, you know, imagine if 1 in 11 Americans had Zika or Ebola or multiple sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease. We wouldn't be able to cross the street without tripping over some scientist trying to figure out what we don't understand about these diseases that have let these epidemics get so out of control. And in this case, just as Jocelyn said in 1920, it's just business as usual. In fact, the people to whom Margaret Chan gave that talk were the leading, you know, officials in the obesity and diabetes community had overseen these epidemics. They had been in charge. Mm. And in any other situation, you would, you know, again, we would be, people would be getting fired, heads would be rolling. And here, nothing. And the reason is pretty simple. We think diabetes is caused primarily by getting fat, and we think people get fat because they eat too much. So we blame obesity on the food industry for making too much tasty food available, and on the fat people, the obese, for not being able to eat in moderation and control their, you know, exercise enough. And so we have explanations. We can blame the victims, and we can blame the industry, and the scientists don't have to question whether or not they screwed up, whether they should be committing some kind of at least career ritual suicide to justify their failure.
I mentioned that you've done some really important work on refined carbohydrates, not just sugars. And I'm wondering, have the things that you've learned with this book, have they made you in any way rethink any of those ideas? Because you do say in the book that it's possible people can live reasonably healthy lives on carbohydrate-rich diets as long as they limit the amount of sugar. That kind of surprised me.
Well, and this is somewhat of a misunderstanding of the cases I was making in my earlier books. So beginning with my infamous New York Times Magazine cover back in 2002, what if it's all been a big fat lie? I was implying that obesity is caused not by eating too – well, actually, in that article, I still thought I was eating too much. That obesity was not caused by the fat content of the diet but by the carbohydrates, and particularly processed, refined carbohydrates and sugars or easily digestible carbs. So that's – you know, the processed flours and starchy vegetables like potatoes and sweet potatoes and then sugars. And then my first book on this, my first two books, Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat, both sort of address those issues separately. And I always said maybe there's something unique about sugar, but the science can't really tell us whether this is speculation, whether this is highly likely to be true or just kind of likely to be true. And in this book, I wanted to drill down on this possibility and try to see how far along the spectrum of highly likely we can it might lie. The point that's clear all along is, you know, you've got all of Southeast Asia, for instance, eating processed carbohydrates, rice. And they didn't have high levels of obesity and diabetes until recently when they transitioned to Western diets. So it could be that the rice is just as bad for them as it is for everyone else. It could be that they've been consuming rice for 2,000 years, so they're evolutionarily adapted to it. You can come up with an infinite number of hypotheses to explain this kind of observation. But the simplest one is that, so what I was arguing in my earlier books is you add, you know, that sugar and easily digestible processed carbs are the causes of these diseases.
Yeah.
But if you have populations that already eat easily digestible processed carbs, then maybe sugar is the key ingredient.
Right.
And you add that to any diet, including Southeast Asians, yeah, or the Katavans are another example who ate a lot of tubers. There are a lot of populations, hunter-gatherer populations, that ate a significant amount of, you know, tubers, sweet potatoes, yams in their diet. But they too become obese and diabetic when they become westernized. So maybe it could be the white flour, it could be the sugar, it could be something else. And that's where you need really clinical trials, yeah, to identify. But sugar, to me, was always the most likely.
Right. You say historical perspective is important. But you also write that medicine today is, here's how you put it, mostly untethered from its history. Explain why this is an important point, because this idea of history is important for you.
Well, this is the thing. Maybe it's because I grew up in the physics community. I studied physics in college, and you do indeed learn physics with the history attached. So when you learn that there is no ether, you learn about the Michelson-Morley experiment and what that showed. And a really good professor will even go over the raw data from that experiment. You learn about the equations have names attached, Maxwell's equations, Einstein's theory of relativity. So you learn not just what you're supposed to believe, but the evidence behind what you're supposed to believe. In medicine and public health and nutrition, this, for whatever reason, I could speculate, it might be different for each field. This doesn't really happen. So fundamental belief systems are taught completely disassociated from their history, and hence they're passed down as they were, like, as though they were chiseled on tablets and passed down from God. And the primary example is this idea that we get fat because we take in more calories than we expend. And I know researchers and public health authorities who will argue that I am quackish, a quack for arguing otherwise. And my response is, you believe this beyond a shadow of a doubt, and yet I understand the history of that idea and you don't. I can tell you who first suggested it. I could tell you when it was embraced. I could tell you who thought that was quackery. I could tell you why it was embraced. So by understanding the history, you begin to understand that scientific hypotheses, even one as seemingly indisputable as obesity being caused by taking in too many calories, have a history. They were debated. There was a counterargument. Mm-hmm. And then you also know whether or not they were rigorously tested and what those tests did or did not show. So to me, that's the only way I can understand the validity of the science in these controversies, is by going back in time, mm-hmm, to understand, not to just do a poll of who believes what today, because there, if groupthink is the order of the day, which it usually is, you will get a consensus. But what you have to find out is a consensus built on really sound evidence. And what was that evidence? What was the competing evidence, et cetera?
Because part of the interesting element of this story is that before the 1970s, it seems like there was a kind of consensus that at least the prime suspect in the cause of diabetes was sugar. I mean, most physicians figured sugar consumption was the main cause. But then by the late 1970s, you say sugar had mostly vanished from the discussion. We'll dig into the details a little bit as we go, but explain generally, what is it that happened? What was the thing that shifted?
Well, there are two periods at which sugar was really emerged as the prime suspect for this disease cluster. So again, in populations and in patients, you get these diseases that cluster together. So if you're obese, you're highly likely to have a high risk of diabetes. If you have type 2 diabetes, which is the common form, you're very likely to be obese. The obese and the diabetics have high risks of heart disease. They have higher risks of cancer and Alzheimer's, of gout, of hypertension, of stroke. So all these diseases tend to cluster together. And diabetes was the easiest one to discuss and had the one I focus on in the book because of its long history. So it begins in the 1920s when Joslin starts to argue that there's an epidemic going on, and other researchers do as well. Actually, the New York City Public Health Commissioner is arguing that clearly sugar is the prime suspect. And at that point, Joslin, who was a wonderful, thoughtful doctor but just didn't remember his biochemistry if he was ever taught it, argues that sugar can't be the culprit because the sugar is a carbohydrate. The Japanese eat a lot of carbohydrates and they don't have a lot of diabetes. Yeah. And Jocelyn didn't know that sugar, beet and cane sugar, is fundamentally different than the carbohydrates you find in rice. And we could discuss, we probably will discuss that. Yeah. And then this comes back in the 1950s with this argument that sugar is uniquely fattening. Diet soft drinks are available, and the sugar industry realizes that there's a whole world of people who are buying diet soft drinks to avoid sugar, and Eisenhower is photographed putting saccharin in his coffee, and the explanation is his doctor told him that sugar is fattening. Yeah. And so the sugar industry launches a public relation advertising campaign to argue that there's no fattening food. A calorie is a calorie. It's just all about how much you eat and exercise. And then the 1960s come along, and researchers are trying to figure out what's the cause of coronary artery disease, heart disease. And there's a dietary fat hypothesis, which is what we grew up in this country believing because it won out. And that's pushed by some very zealous nutritionists who are, you know, God told them dietary fat's the cause of heart disease. And that's all they're going to believe, regardless of what their studies say. And this British nutritionist comes along, John Yudkin, arguing it's sugar. And meanwhile, for the first time, you could start doing research where you could really start feeding animals and you know, subjects in the laboratory high or low sugar diets and seeing what happens to their blood pressure, their blood lipids, you know, cholesterol, triglycerides. And you start getting a lot of researchers saying, hey, look, you feed people sugar, they seem to get this sort of cluster of metabolic abnormalities that goes along with diabetes. And by the early 70s, the sugar industry itself holds commissions a poll to be done of physicians, and most physicians think that sugar plays a crucial role in diabetes. But the nutrition heart disease argument is still being dominated by the anti-fat faction. And the National Institutes of Health is now spending hundreds of millions of dollars to test the hypothesis that dietary fat causes heart disease. And the sugar industry, worried about these guys like Yudkin or saying it's sugar, put together basically a public relations campaign in which they hire the very influential researchers who think dietary fat is the problem to write learned reports and learned studies that in turn influence the FDA and how they perceive the status of sugar as a food additive and the country at large. And by the time you're coming out of the 1970s, in effect, well, the dietary fat hypothesis has failed to be confirmed, but just the process of confirming it, of spending so much money testing it, it's convinced everyone it must be right. Yeah. It's a kind of surreal phenomena. And the idea has become that sugar is benign, in part because all these people are arguing the problem is fat. There's actually the New York Times health reporter Jane Brody writes a story back then where she discusses how sugar is a kind of generally noxious nutrient that none of us need to eat. And yet some people think sugar causes heart disease, but most people think it's fat. It's probably fat. And so by 1980 or so, to even study sugar is to be accused by your peers in the community as being a bit of a quack.
Yeah.
And the theory just evaporates for 20 or 30 years. Then it comes back through different ways we can talk about.
Right.
That's Gary Taubes. His book is The Case Against Sugar. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about sugar and the science journalist Gary Taubes' expose. Taubes says sugar is the key culprit to a list of conditions and diseases that plague us these days. He sees sugar as the tobacco of this century, extremely dangerous and backed by a powerful industry. His book explores the history of our relationship with sugar and mostly the science about why delicious sweet sugar is making us so sick.
I want to back up a little bit and talk about some of the history, which is really interesting. How long have humans been trying to extract and refine sugar? It's interesting how far this goes back in human history.
Oh, it goes back like 10,000 years. Yeah. You know, first just chewing on the sugar cane, which is mildly sweet and kind of in the same way that chewing on coca leaves, you get a little bit of cocaine. And so you get the mild high from the cocaine. You get mild high from chewing on sugar cane. And then it spreads from Indonesia into India and China. And about 2,500 years ago, they start refining it, in effect breaking down the cane, getting the sugar out of it with a series of steps so that you end up with something that begins to look like refined sugar as we know it today. And coincidentally, right about the same time, Hindu physicians in India start talking about diagnosing diabetes in patients and suggesting maybe it's caused by eating sugar.
Yeah.
And then it spreads to the Middle East by the 9th century AD, and you get very active sugar industries throughout the Mediterranean. The Crusaders, when they went to Israel and Lebanon for the Crusades, noticed the sugar cane growing outside the fields and would chew on the sugar cane, and it would make it, there are quotes from observers back then that it made basically the whole crusade thing worthwhile for them just to get to chew on a little sugar cane.
Yeah.
Anyway, when they return to Europe, the sugar goes back with them.
Right.
And for the next 400 years, it's actively grown all around the Mediterranean. It's got to be – sugarcane has to grow in tropical climates.
Right.
It can't grow in temperate climates. You need a lot of rainfall. So very specific areas. And it's a horrible job cutting and refining sugarcane. So it's a kind of job you can't even pay peasants to do.
No.
So from the very get-go, it's associated with slavery and forced labor. And then with the discovery of the Americas, actually Columbus on his second voyage takes sugarcane with him to Hispaniola and tries to raise it there. And then his pilot takes sugarcane with him on his voyage of discovery down to Brazil. And Brazil is the first country that creates sort of a viable sugar refining industry and starts sending sugar back to Spain. And then it just – you know, the Caribbean islands become, in effect, monocultures for growing sugar, and the whole the slave trade, predominantly most of the slaves being brought over, something like 2 in 3 slaves are used, live and die pretty awful lives harvesting sugarcane and refining the sugarcane. And it's, you know, I talk about this in the book in part because I'm it's just, you know, the things that we would put up with, the horrible crimes we would commit to humanity for the sake of the sugar fix.
Yeah.
And you have to always ask yourself, is this a drug we're talking about,
right,
or is this just a this sort of wonderful pause that refreshes?
Well, you get to that question a bit anyway. Is it addictive?
Well, and the answer once again is this, science can't really tell us.
Yeah.
So, you know, post-1970, nobody was funding sugar research. So the idea that sugar was this benign substance that we were putting in foods to replace the fat we were taking out. There were a few labs, maybe 3 in the world, that were studying whether or not sugar was addictive. And the work in a French laboratory was, you know, if you're a rat or a mouse, it was clearly a problem. He would addict rats to cocaine or heroin, and they would be able to sort of push a lever in their cages and get their daily bolus of coke or heroin. And then he would offer them sugar instead, sugar water. And they would have a few days to decide basically whether they wanted to stick with the sugar water or stick with the cocaine and heroin. And invariably, they decided that the sugar high was the better one. And then you see, you know, there are like 12-step programs, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which talks about sugar as a kind of it's almost like the methadone for drinking, you know. And those of us who live in urban centers near an AA office, often you often know it's there because on breaks from the Alcoholics Anonymous meetings will be people eating ice cream cones and candy bars standing outside. It's kind of a common phenomenon in this world. But the evidence, you know, all we know is it's very addictive to rodents, it's anyone who has a child. And my writing of this book was clearly informed by the fact that I'm a parent of two pre-adolescent boys. I don't think you really need scientists to tell you that there's something unique about this clearly psychoactive substance that is a problem. I mean, a major obligation of parenting is rationing your children's sweets consumption, and that's been known for a century. So my favorite statement on this was from my friend, the wonderful journalist historian Charles Mann, who in his book 1493, which documents the spread of foods and plants around the world after Columbus, what's called the Columbian Exchange. And one of these plants was sugar. And he says, scientists today debate amongst themselves whether sugar is an addictive substance or people just act like it is.
Right.
And clearly we act like it is.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the sugar industry. How big are we talking in terms of the influence of this sugar lobby, the sugar industry now in the scheme of things?
Well, the sugar lobby was always one of the most powerful lobbies, in part because most of the sugar, until the invention of the beet sugar industry, at which point, that was in the mid-19th century, at which point you can now grow sugar in temperate climates. Most of the sugar was imported into the United States. There were tariffs. There were import tax issues. So it was always a very powerful lobby from the get-go. And in the 1930s, when President Roosevelt had issues with the sugar industry, he said it's by far the most powerful lobby in Washington. What's interesting is, you know, we just talked about sort of how people act like sugar's addictive, and sugar's this incredibly in populations, as with children, populations will consume as much sugar as they can afford up until, perhaps beyond the point they get obese and diabetic. And so you would ask yourself, what do you need a lobby for?
Right.
What do you need a public relations campaign for when you have such a wildly successful product? I mean, sugar and cigarettes were clearly two of the most successful products in the late 19th and, 20th century. And the answer is every time people attacked sugar as being unhealthy or fattening or causing diabetes or tooth decay or you name it. I mean, in the 60s, there was even the health organic food advocate, J.J. Rodal, blamed Hitler and Napoleon's excesses on their sweet tooths. Going a bit too far, I think, beyond what the data will defend.
Yeah.
Anyway, you needed the sugar lobby to step in and both, you know, primarily argue that they're not healthy. It just did what any industry would do under those circumstances. But because their product was tied so closely to excess consumption and these chronic diseases, they were exceedingly active in fighting this battle to make sure and doing it behind the scenes to make sure that their product won out. Although I don't really blame them because, again, the great majority of the community thought that dietary fat was a problem in the 60s and sugar was benign. And the nutritionists and obesity researchers were arguing we get fat because we eat too much. And so the only thing we should care about is the calories, not the nutrient itself.
The idea of this energy imbalance, that was a big theory. Obesity and energy imbalance, those were the two pillars that you say have been the principal obstacles to really getting at the truth about the effect of sugar. Talk a little bit about what you say is this important distinction that sugar has a unique physiological metabolic effect on the human body, that it triggers these disorders, that it behaves differently. This is the critical point. It behaves differently than other carbohydrates.
And this is what in the book I refer to this energy balance idea as the gift that keeps on giving.
Right.
Because the nutritionists and obesity researchers believe this beyond a shadow of a doubt. And weirdly enough, they still do. And one way to think about it, when we're discussing pharmaceuticals, you know, antidepressants, blood pressure lowering medications, anti-anxiety medications, statins for cholesterol, there are multiple variables that we consider very important. The first one is dose. milliliters, milligrams. And the second one would be the physiological effect of these drugs. What do they do? What do they upregulate and downregulate in the body that actually serves to work as a, you know, to reduce depression or reduce blood pressure or reduce cholesterol? And we assume that the greater the dose, the greater the effect, up to a point. So what we know about the macronutrients in the diet, carbohydrates, proteins, fats, and there are different types of carbohydrates, different types of protein, different types of fats, is they all have different physiological effects in the human body. Our bodies respond dramatically differently to carbohydrates and proteins and fats, and they respond differently to sugar than they do to other carbohydrates. In fact, the fructose component of sugar, which is half of a sugar molecule, is metabolized in the liver. Other carbs, which break down to glucose, are metabolized in, you know, every cell in the body. So we know that they have different physiological effects, just like drugs do. And then our measure of the dosage when we talk about foods is calories. We could have measured them in grams or, you know, liquid doses, but we chose for reasons of historical precedence to make the measurement in calories. So what the obesity and nutrition community decides to do in 1920 is decide that the only thing that matters is the dose. So it doesn't matter what physiological effect these nutrients have or don't have, and particularly on these hormones that in the 1960s are understood to regulate the accumulation of fat in fat cells very carefully, the only thing we care about is the dose. So a calorie is a calorie is a calorie, and the fact – and it's like imagine if we were saying a milligram of Zoloft, an antidepressant, does the same thing as a milligram of Lipitor, a cholesterol-lowering drug, which does the same thing as a milligram of a blood pressure-lowering drug. That would be inane, but we – basically, that's what the nutrition and obesity community has decided. For – again, I understand the reasons. I find it almost incomprehensibly naive. The 1960s come along. For the first time in history, researchers have a tool that allows them to measure hormones in the bloodstream accurately and allows them to measure the forms in which fat is found in the bloodstreams accurately, two different tools. And now they can understand how foods influence hormones and blood fats and how hormones influence fat storage and the oxidation, the burning of fats for fuel in the human body. And now you have this hypothesis that says, look, it's all driven by this hormone insulin. Right. Or it's primarily dominated by this hormone insulin. And insulin we secrete in response primarily to the carbohydrate content of the diet. And that hypothesis is never really taken seriously because by that time the nutrition obesity researchers have been hearing this mantra, calorie is a calorie is a calorie, for 50 years. They believe it, you know, dogmatically. And they're also focusing on saturated fat as a cause of heart disease. So a hypothesis that focuses on carbohydrates as a cause of obesity, diabetes, and the diseases that associate with them, including heart disease, is a very inconvenient hypothesis. Hmm.
Gary Taubes, his book is The Case Against Sugar. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio. Go see our latest short on Radio West Films. It's a love story, but it's complicated. And I don't really want to say much more about it because it's kind of surprising, but it's beautiful. And it's sad. It's about Bonnie, a poet, and Mark, a philosopher. And their story plays out in Provo. I hope that's enough to get you to go watch it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Gary Taubes. In his book, he says, sugar is the principal cause of the chronic diseases that could kill us in the 21st century. It's called The Case Against Sugar.
What did you learn about artificial sweeteners? There's a great story you tell about President Teddy Roosevelt, who had been told by his physician to use saccharin to keep his weight down. Maybe you could mention that and just talk about what we know, you know, the question as to whether or not, because this is a big question. Do artificial sweeteners have a similar effect to sugar? Do they stimulate an insulin response, those kinds of things? What did you learn about artificial sweeteners?
Well, and this is, so some of these artificial sweeteners, saccharin in particular, goes back to, you know, the 1890s. Cyclamates date, if I remember correctly, the 1930s. So they had a long history of use, and they were used. So Roosevelt, who got in a fight with the lead chemist at would later become the Food and Drug Administration. This guy didn't like any chemical additives, and he thought they should all be banned. And Roosevelt was like, look, I got a weight problem. My doctor says I should take saccharin instead of sugar. I don't care whether in my life it's worth the trade-off. Right. And this was always the issue. So through the 1950s, saccharin and cyclamates were allowed for basically people whose doctors told them they should consume these drugs. They're kind of like medical marijuana in California.
Yeah.
And then in the 1950s, suddenly soft drinks start to be produced made from artificial sweeteners. And even though they're sort of targeted at the diabetic population, suddenly they find that they have huge markets because everyone who's trying to maintain their weight wants to consume these artificial sweetened beverages and at least avoid the sugar calories, if not avoid the sugar itself. And in the 1960s, the sugar industry realized they've got this huge challenge to their viability, not just because the soft drink industry is happy to use artificial sweeteners instead of sugar because the artificial sweeteners are cheaper. People are going to buy them. What the heck? Mm-hmm. So the sugar industry starts funding research desperately to establish that the artificial sweeteners have caused health problems. And I mean, literally, they're funding research where these people are virtually drowning rats and they're, for generations in artificial sweetened beverages to demonstrate that they could cause birth defects or something. Eventually, one group manages to generate bladder cancer in rats, and the Food and Drug Administration, there's a government amendment that says that they have to address whether or not food additives are generally recognized as safe. And then there's something called the Delaney Amendment, which says that if food causes cancer in – if a food additive causes cancer in one laboratory animal, it's got to be banned. So the sugar – the FDA bans cyclamates. They try to ban saccharin because there's some similar poorly done studies with saccharin. There's a huge write-in campaign and they decide to allow it to continue to be produced, although with a warning label on it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, this simply taints. So the idea comes out. By the 1970s, there's this idea that dietary sweeteners are just naturally unhealthy. If they're, right. they're carcinogens, they're worse. They're chemicals, even though sugar is a chemical. It just
right.
happens to be one that grows in plants.
Yeah.
And there's a 1975, the National Academy of Sciences has a symposium to discuss these sweeteners. And Philip Handler, who was the president of the National Academy of Sciences and a terrific scientist, put it in perspective for me, which is the same perspective that Teddy Roosevelt had, which is what I want to know is which is worse, sugar or artificial sweeteners. Because if I can't live without my food sweetened,
yeah.
and I prefer to have my food sweetened, then I want to know which is worse. And if something like saccharin, which is, 100 or 300 times as sweet as sugar, gram for gram, means that if I'm going to, on one hand, consume 100 pounds of sugar per capita, and on the other hand, consume maybe a half or a third of a pound of saccharin per year, that's what I want to know, which is worse for me.
Yeah.
And in my mind, and I think in Handler's as well, clearly the sugar is the problem. But again, I think ideally we all lose our sweet tooth and we drink water and we drink our coffee unsweetened and we don't need desserts to, bring joy to our lives. But I admit that I'm a food zealot.
Yeah. How realistic do you feel about that? I mean, it is one of the things that comes up, the sort of increase when you're talking about high fructose corn syrup and other additives that are really sweet. Can we ever go back to the point where our Wonder Bread or our, you know, any other product, just name them, that are packed with sugar now, where it isn't that way? I mean, can we ever really reverse course in that sense?
Yeah, and I doubt it. I mean, clearly we've gotten to a point that it's probably hopeless. But on the other hand, I said one of the facts that informed the writing of my books was that I have two pre-adolescent child. The other thing that very much informed my thinking on this was I was a cigarette smoker. So I smoked for 20 years. I tried to quit effectively every day for probably 18 years. Occasionally I succeeded for weeks or months, even a year or two. At the present, I've succeeded now for going on 18 years. When you're a smoker, you cannot imagine life without cigarettes. Yeah. It's so interwoven into all your emotional states. From the moment you wake up and have your first cigarette to the last cigarette at night, there's cigarettes after meals, there's cigarettes after exercise, there's cigarettes after sex, there's cigarettes you take a walk, you get in the car, whatever you do. And so for a smoker, they can't imagine ever being happy without cigarettes. And when you quit, the first 3 weeks you're miserable, undeniably miserable, if you make it 3 weeks, because you're these brain cells in the reward center of your brain that technically called the nucleus accumbens are crying out for nicotine. And then you just settle into maybe 3 months of general unhappiness and a year of mild depression. And after 2 or 3 years, you get to the point where you can't imagine you ever smoked. So today, I cannot imagine smoking a cigarette. I can't imagine that I ever smoked a cigarette, let alone that it was my primary source of joy in life. And I think that transition can happen for the population as well. But they have to, as you point out, the sugar is in virtually everything, not just as a sweetener, but because it's in such a useful food additive in many different ways. So it's in salad dressings and processed meats and peanut butter and virtually everything that comes in a package that is in bottled water or artificially sweetened beverages. So in that sense, it's very hard to avoid. Yeah. The question is, how much damage is that sugar doing compared to the sugary beverages and the candies and the ice cream and the chocolates and the desserts, which 200 years ago were virtually non-existent in modern diets, and people got by. They found their joy elsewhere, and just like smokers found their joy elsewhere before they got addicted to cigarettes, and drug addicts found their joy elsewhere before they got addicted to their drug of choice. So it's possible on one level, at least on individual levels, and I know this anecdotally, I hear from people all the time, to get rid of your sweet tooth, to effectively give up sugar, and to be happy.
Gary Taubes, let me ask you this finally. We were talking earlier that it's hard to make a definitive causal link. But you say in the book that these kinds of experiments are, you know, the idea of labeling sugar, for example, as a toxin, that the experiments that would pull that off are expensive. Few researchers think they'll ever be conducted. You mentioned that as of last fall, I think it was, fewer than a dozen clinical trials were going on in the U.S. So how do you get at this question if you don't seem to see in the future any more work, any more clinical trials? What's going to happen with sugar?
Well, you know, again, clearly I wrote this book to, again, prosecute the case against sugar and give people the information they need to make the decision themselves. You know, the best you could say is it's highly likely that sugar is causally linked to these diseases. That's what I would say. And if it's highly likely, then I'm willing to avoid them. And then people can quit sugar for 3 months and see how they feel. They could treat it like they might cigarettes or alcohol and say, I'm going to go a month or 2 months or 3 months without it and see if it's worth it. Get to the point where they start to get over the cravings. But I also think, you know, if I was king of the universe, what would happen? the federal government would say, hey, we have these horrible diabetes epidemics going on and they're bankrupting our healthcare system and we need to do something about it. So the first thing we're going to do is re-examine our assumptions about these diseases. Do we really understand what's causing these diseases? What part of the Western diet is doing it? Is sugar a viable hypothesis? And if it is, and I hope they're going to agree, then you know, you get the smartest minds. You do what you would do with any massive epidemic. You get the smartest minds to figure out how to test this stuff. You don't rely on a journalist, regardless of whether or not he, you know, his academic credentials. There are trials that can be done that would be in the $10 to $20 million range, if they're done correctly and in government facilities, you can really begin to determine whether sugar has these toxic qualities independent of its calories. Again, it would still take 5 to 10 years. I'm hesitant about regulation because the arguments I make in my book, one of the reasons we got into this situation is because very well-meaning liberals like myself decided that they should convince the entire country to go on a low-fat diet and didn't know what the unintended consequences would be.
Yeah.
So I'm hesitant to see the same thing happen with sugar because we never know what the unintended consequences are. But the more we have these discussions, the more the information and the more people even discuss taxation in very, you know, in different cities, the more the message gets out that very smart people think that sugar is a real problem and sugar consumption has to cut way back, and particularly sugar consumption in our children.
That's Gary Taubes. His book is called The Case Against Sugar. He joined us from the studios of the Journalism School at the University of California, Berkeley. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Adrian Moranville. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.